Rogues Gallery Uncovered. Bad behaviour in period costume. A non-judgmental return, after nearly a year, into the scandalous lives of history's greatest libertines, Lotharios, and complete bastards. This podcast contains adult themes and a touch of colourful language. So there. Filming, floating, and fucking around. All at sea during the golden age of Hollywood. With David Niven and Errol Flynn. Before we set off on another roguish voyage, however, I'll very quickly address my almost 12-month absence from the podcast. It's nothing dramatic and it really won't take long. I was just busy, that's all. You see, while being loads of fun, researching, writing and producing each episode takes quite a bit of time, and as my day job also involves writing about history and recording voiceovers, I seem to be spending most of every day doing exactly the same thing. And the last thing I wanted to do was to stop enjoying making the podcast or see it as a chore, so I stepped away from my lonely office for a bit to spend some time interacting with people. I went on some adventures, both solo and with my wife, which took me from, and this sounds like a really bad book blurb, the marketplaces of Marrakesh to the northern lights of Norway via the deserts of Saudi Arabia. I also got offered some really exciting writing gigs, which meant I was really busy for money. A great place to be for a freelancer and one to make the most of. So anyway, I've had a break and now I fancy rebooting Rogues. I really hope there's still an audience for Bad Behaviour in period costume and you still enjoy what I do. There are some really fascinating ne'er-do-wells coming up in the next few months. I shall be releasing episodes every 2 weeks on a Wednesday morning. And don't forget, you can visit the website at roguesgalleryuncovered.com or email me at simon@roguesgalleryonline.com. Both addresses are in the show notes. Right, if you're a regular listener, you'll know the drill. Here we go. The following tale is written in the present tense of the period in which it's set, and as such, may contain attitudes and opinions of the protagonists and their times, which would today be considered unacceptable. As I'm not a 1930s Hollywood film star, enjoying or abusing my celebrity, depending on how you look at it, those attitudes and opinions are not necessarily mine. Oh, and if you're Australian or Tasmanian, I unreservedly apologise for the accent crimes which follow. The Ocean off Catalina, 1936. David Niven watches as the speedboat bounces across the waves, leaving him alone in the water, miles from shore. Knowing that within minutes, the man at its helm will be gleefully having sex with the girl that he invited along for the afternoon, Niven begins the long, slow paddle home. The outrageous cad who has marooned him at sea so he can screw Niven's girlfriend is also his housemate and his new best friend. Bloody Errol Flynn. The two of them had read about a chap in France called Darcy Rutherford, who claimed to have invented a new sport called water skiing, and Flynn was eager to try it out. He'd got the Warner Brothers prop department to knock up a couple of crude wooden skis, and the two had zoomed around the ocean off Catalina Island with Niven's starstruck date watching enthralled. His turn on the skis over, Niven gave her a cheery wave before sinking down into the water exhausted and waiting to be picked up. Only he wasn't. The tow rope was pulled in, and with the world's sexiest man's laughter ringing in his ears, Hollywood's newest British star found himself all at sea with only a plank for company. So long, sport. Bloody Flynn. You could always count on him to let you down. Niven and Flynn had met at a house party thrown by Flynn's fiery, soon-to-be wife, Lily Demeter. Despite both initially thinking that the other was gay, it soon became apparent that booze and women were interests that they very much had in common. During the filming of The Charge of the Light Brigade, in which they both starred, the actors cruised Hollywood Boulevard's seediest dives, cementing their friendship by getting pissed and picking up girls. One morning, as Niven was buttoning himself into his 27th Lancers uniform and wrestling with yet another spectacular hangover, Flynn appeared. The last time Niven had seen him, he was disappearing into the night with two girls that he'd met in a club, and Niv was eager to know how the evening's sexual escapades had panned out. He was surprised to learn that it had in fact been a bit of a dud. "I needed a few more drinks, old sport," Flynn recalled sadly. "Hadn't had enough to get the old cock hard enough for two." Filming was later briefly halted when Flynn beat the shit out of a huge stuntman who had shoved a lance up his horse's ass as a joke. With Light Brigade in the can, Niven continued his relationship with Merle Oberon, while Flynn settled into a married life of fighting and fucking. He called his passionate wife Tiger Lil, and often said that he had to be pretty nimble on his feet to avoid injury. It was a passionate relationship. When he was an hour late to a party thrown by Lily in honour of their first meeting, she smashed a champagne bottle on his head, and then found herself on the receiving end of a Flynn right hook as he sank unconscious to the floor. Recovering in hospital, Flynn bemoaned the fact that while he was perceived as a great womaniser, he never had to seduce women at all, as they threw themselves at him night and day. "For Christ's sake," he muttered, "I come home and they're hiding under my bed." With rows becoming louder, more frequent and increasingly violent, Flynn decided after 2 months to move out. And as Niven was desperately attempting to avoid marriage with Merle Oberon, the two decided to share a house together. They rented Rosalind Russell's place at 601 North Linden Drive. Flynn was the bigger star, so paid the larger share of the rent, and therefore had the master bedroom, except on special occasions. The pair then immersed themselves in a lifestyle that The Hollywood Reporter called a trespass against all good taste. Constant drinking, a merry-go-round of girls, drugs — Flynn often popped a pinch of cocaine on the end of his Johnson while Niven wandered around off his face on marijuana — and loud orgies were the domestic routine, particularly on a Sunday. The two also delighted in pulling pranks on their usually inebriated guests. A wizened and elderly film extra, who went by the name of OK Freddy, had an enormous cock that they encouraged him to show to everybody who walked through their door. At a dinner party, they dressed the hapless stooge as a waiter and got him to lie his vast appendage on a silver platter, surrounded by cold cuts of ham and some appetizing prawns. All went well until a particularly peckish woman stabbed at it with a fork. Freddy ran shrieking to the bathroom. Definitely not okay. Although separated from his wife, Flynn made sure that he stopped orgying at least twice a week in order to visit her. The couple would go to parties, where they bitched at each other constantly before disappearing to enjoy loud and energetic makeup sex, before returning to the party and being vile to each other again until it was time to go home. Always up for a good scrap, Flynn would keep himself in fighting trim by sparring with various tough guys in the garden. He and director John Huston once pummeled each other insensible for several hours as puzzled visitors sipped cocktails inside. It was good to be prepared, as Hollywood womanising Flynn style had its risks, and Niven was nothing if not the perfect wingman. One afternoon, when he returned from the studio, Niven spotted a suspicious figure lurking in the garden. Fortifying himself with whiskey, he apprehended the intruder, who turned out to be an obsessively jealous film producer who had a severe crush on an actress called Joan Bennett. He was convinced that she was upstairs having sex with Flynn, and it took all of Niven's considerable charm to convince him that this most definitely wasn't the case and he should leave. What Niv didn't mention, however, was that Miss Bennett was indoors, only waiting expectantly in the living room because Flynn hadn't come home yet. The film producer left, but later he approached another man that he suspected of having designs on Joan Bennett in a car park and then shot him in the testicles. So that day, Niven quite literally saved Flynn's balls. On another occasion, Niven watched incredulously as Flynn, outraged by something that gossip columnist Hedda Hopper had written about him, knocked on her front door and, when she opened it, began to vigorously masturbate. Despite the fact that she was laughing in his face, a determined Flynn managed to achieve orgasm all over her front step, before, his point being made, making a dignified exit. So now, Niven's floating in the Pacific, making slow but steady progress towards Donald Coleman's yacht that's bobbing some distance away. Hang on. Is that a shark? Bloody Flynn! He should have known that a combination of Flynn and the ocean wasn't a good idea. Following his success in the movie Captain Blood, Flynn had recently bought himself a 65 ketch named Sirocco, and with a crew of drinking buddies, and of course female guests, would go sailing every week. Regular crew members were given a badge emblazoned with an erect penis motif and the legend FFF, Flynn's Flying Fuckers. Essentially, the vessel was a floating knocking shop, or bag shanty, as Flynn liked to call it, and his male friends were always guaranteed a good time. There was consternation once when Flynn invited them to sit around the table in the main salon, and with no women present, the assembled FFFs thought they were in for a boring weekend of actual sailing. That was until the girls that Flynn had hidden beneath the table unzipped their flies and started blowing them. Then it was business as usual. One of Niven's jobs aboard the Sirocco was using an ice pick to chip ice from a huge block to put in people's drinks. During a heavy swell, his hand slipped, and he managed to impale his index finger on the frozen slab of ice. Flynn was at his side within moments, only it wasn't to help. He burst out laughing and left Niven pinned to the ice while he ran to get the girls, one of whom fainted when she saw Niven's injury. As he thrashes the water to a foam, shouting, "Shark!" and desperately trying to get Ronald Coleman's attention, Niven begins to wonder if the fun he undoubtedly has with Flynn is really worth the aggravation. Later, aboard Coleman's yacht, trembling and guzzling brandy, he contemplates how close he came to being eaten alive. Flynn arrives to take him home, and the emotionally drained and recently cuckolded film star expects his fellow actor to be, at the very least, a bit contrite. "G'day, sport. Betty says hi. Eaten by a shark? Jesus, sport. I wish I'd seen that." Bloody Flynn. Both Niven and Flynn were well known as raconteurs, self-mythologizers, or shameless bullshit artists, depending on your point of view. So how much of this is 100% accurate is up for debate. What has become apparent over the years, however, seems to be that while initially Niven found buddying up with Flynn to be loads of fun, over time, Flynn's selfishness started to wear a little bit thin. This is part of an interview that Niven gave to the author Michael Munn in 1979. "There was a time when Flynn made me angrier than I can ever remember being. I was out of the house, and he took a call from George Stevens, who was one of the best directors in Hollywood. He wanted to know if I'd be interested in a part in Gunga Din. Of course, he should have gone through Goldwyn, but he wanted to talk to me initially. Fred Astaire had worked with him and recommended me." Flynn never passed on the message. Not long after, Fred said to me, "Did you accept George's offer?" I said, "What offer?" He said, "I think you better call George Stevens." So I did, and he said, "I'm sorry you chose to ignore my offer." I said, "I didn't know what offer he was talking about." So he told me about his conversation with Flynn on the telephone. He wanted me to play one of the key characters in Gunga Din, but because I hadn't had the decency to call him back, he gave the part to Douglas Fairbanks Jr. He'd also told Flynn to let me know that if I wanted, he was prepared to get RKO Studios to buy my contract from Goldwyn, and they'd do more for me than Goldwyn ever could. I said, "I swear, George, Flynn never said a word to me, or I'd have been on the phone to you the moment I'd heard." Stephen said, "If you want to get on in Hollywood, don't hang around with sons of bitches like Flynn, who don't give a damn for anyone but himself. He'll ruin you." And he was right. Flynn almost wrecked my career because he thought it was funny not to tell me about the most important phone call I ever had at that stage of my career. I never forgave him for that. The other unforgivable sin that Niven believed Flynn had committed was to reveal to the papers that when Merle Oberon had gone overseas for work, he embarked on an affair with another actress called Virginia Bruce. Niven swore Flynn to secrecy, so when the press got hold of it, not only was Merle Oberon furious and upset, but Niven also found himself in his studio's bad books. Apparently Samuel Goldwyn told him, "Keep your dick in your pants and out of the newspapers." Niven was convinced that Flynn had shot his mouth off, knowing it would become public. He moved out of North Linden Drive, but the two acted together again in the absolutely wonderful movie The Dawn Patrol, which many see as the start of Niven's bona fide stardom. Unfortunately, while they were celebrating the end of shooting, according to the same 1979 interview, Flynn made a random drunken pass at his one-time best mate by grabbing his crotch. These are Niven's words from that interview. "That's the sort of thing schoolboys might do. And I felt that it was time he really grew up, and I told him so. And he said, 'Oh, come on, sport, you and I, we're pals, and there's nothing wrong in a couple of pals having a little fun together.' And then he tried to grab me again. I had no idea where this came from. I told him he should grow up and that I was heading home, and he got rather nasty and was almost spitting with rage. He yelled, 'I think you're the one who should grow up, Niven. This is Hollywood. People here are phonies. They fuck anything that moves. What makes you so fucking different?' And I said, 'Being loyal to my friends. You should try it.' And after that, I never wanted to see him again. He tried calling me, and he even wrote me a letter saying how sorry he was. I came to realise that most of the people who called himself his friends were hangers-on. I felt very sorry for him, and I was sorry our friendship ended the way it did. I'm still angry about what happened, and I'm sad too. I had the best of times with Flynn, and I had the worst. What did Dickens say? It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And that's what I had with Flynn." For such a raucous tale, that was a really downbeat ending. Sorry about that. It just goes to show that even the most classic roguish partnerships don't necessarily last forever. Next time on Rogues Gallery Uncovered, Confessions of an 18th Century Teenage Raver. Enjoy a couple of nights on the town in Georgian London with teenage rake William Hickey. If you've enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to follow or subscribe, and it would be lovely, if you feel so inclined, to give it a high rating or a nice review. Get in touch and let me know what you think of the podcast, and if you have any suggestions as to rogues you'd like me to feature, then I'd love to hear from you. You can find Rogues Gallery Uncovered on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. Or, and this is your best bet, just visit roguesgalleryuncovered.com. There's loads more roguish content there, and you can sign up to my newsletter and become a lovable rogue. That's all for now. I really hope you've enjoyed the return of Rogues Gallery Uncovered, and I'll see you yesterday.